And our special guest tonight, Jim Marrs. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. This hour, we're going to talk about the alien agenda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Jim Marrs, our guest. Jim, at what point in your career did you do Alien Agenda? Because it seems to intertwine with a lot of things you've investigated.
Well, actually it does. With the success of my book, Crossfire, about the Kennedy assassination, as I travel around the country, I'd ask people, you know, what do you think's the next big, deep, dark, secret government cover-up? And from boardrooms in New York to taxi cab drivers, I mean, almost unanimously, people said, well, we'd like to know what's the deal with the UFOs. And I thought, well, you know, I would too, because I have been keeping up and keeping an eye on the UFO question since I was a young guy in the 50s. And I can prove that because I still have a watercolor I did that depicts a large silver cigar-shaped object that landed near Levelland, Texas. And I read the news accounts and then painted this watercolor. So, and I also wrote about it in the early 60s in the university, saying that we need to take a look and figure out what this is. It's really incredible. But what's really incredible now, George, is that there seems to be a tie-in between Kennedy and the UFOs. We now have a document that was dated at the time of the Roswell crash, okay, and 1947, and it's from a unit called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which, when I first saw this thing, I went, oh, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, how did this document get here?
Yeah, right? Wait a minute, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit? But actually, this has been verified. There was such a unit. And now that, you know, I believe on another times that you and I were together, we discussed the Aurora spaceship crash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, that was when you were on with Linda.
Exactly. And that took place in 1897. And we are now aware of perhaps other recovered non-human-made objects that took place prior to 1947. So all of a sudden, it makes perfect sense that they would have an interplanetary phenomenon unit. So, in this report from 1947, first off, it states that, you have to pardon me, I've got these sinuses.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right. Get a little glass of water. A live cough on the
whoa,
air.
Whoa, yeah.
Millions of people just heard you cough now, Jim.
I'm sorry. It never does this until I get on an interview. In his report, it says, first reports indicated that the first crash investigators from Roswell Army Air Field thought that Landing Zone 1 was the remains of a top-secret Mogul balloon. But when scientists from Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory arrived to inspect the landing zone, it became apparent to all that what had crashed in the desert was something out of this world. Later in the report, it says, with the pending approval of James Forrestal as new Secretary of Defense, it is certain that he will be briefed on certain aspects of the discoveries.
Isn't he the one who jumped out a window eventually?
They said he jumped.
Yeah. Yeah, with probably fingerprints on his shoulders or something, huh?
It has become known to CIC that some of the recovery operation was shared with Representative John F. Kennedy, Massachusetts Democrat elected to Congress in 1946, son of Joseph E. Kennedy, who served on the Commission of Organization of the Executive Branch of the Government. Kennedy had limited duty as naval officer assigned to naval intelligence during the war. It is believed that the information was obtained from a source in Congress who is close to the Secretary of the Air Force. So
that's a pretty dramatic thing. I
we
have heard
find that Kennedy of all the members of Congress, apparently knew about the reality of the crash at Roswell. But, you know, I guess he went along with everybody else when they said this is national security and we don't want to panic people and we don't, you know, we got to keep this under wraps. But then in the early 60s, there's an account from two men at what is now known as Area 50, Area 51.
51.
Yeah, that said Kennedy was coming to visit and that some of the German scientists and scientists at the Area 51 were a little bit concerned, but not too concerned because they were laughing and saying, oh, you know, we'll just, like everybody else, we'll tell him there's nothing here. And that, but then later they overheard these same scientists screaming bloody murder because they said Kennedy was threatening to cut their budgets. And I think what happened there was is that he went to Area 51. They gave him the usual song and dance about nothing unearthly here. And he knew better because he had been briefed in 1947. And this was further supported by a FBI wiretap in the summer of 1962 that was between a friend of Marilyn Monroe's and the famous journalist Dorothy Kilgallen. And the friend of Marilyn Monroe's said Marilyn was very upset, felt like she'd kind of been jilted by the Kennedy brothers, and that she was threatening to hold a news conference and reveal secrets. Well, one of these secrets was missiles in Cuba. Well, this was several months before the Cuban Missile Crisis and when we all got told about the Soviet missiles in Cuba. But the number one thing she said she was going to tell was how President Kennedy had told her he had visited a secret air base and viewed things from space. That was his trip to Area 51. And then we have a document that's controversial because there's no provenance of where it came from. It was one of these leaked documents. But it shows on November the 12th, 1963, Kennedy sent a memo to the head of Central Intelligence Agency ordering him to turn over all the UFO files to the White House. Well, this would have been tantamount to making it public since, you know, the White House has got everybody down to interns and somebody would have blabbed. So, but to add strength to this questionable document is a legitimate document out of the Kennedy Library that shows on that very date, November the 12th, Kennedy was talking about space matters and had written to James Webb, head of NASA at that time, that we were going into joint space exploration with the Soviet Union and that he wanted him to implement that program. And in the White House memo ordering the head of the CIA to turn over UFO files, his rationale was, he says, because we're going into joint space exploration with the Soviets and we have to separate the knowns from the unknowns so that they won't take this as some kind of scheme to spy on them. Now, George, I ask you, isn't it a story that in 1963, in the height of the Cold War, we were going to go into joint space exploration with the Russians?
Absolutely bizarre.
Very bizarre, but it's absolutely true because the son of Nikita Khrushchev came out and said that he was aware of this and verified that Kennedy and Khrushchev had worked out a deal. See, Kennedy was working to try to end the Cold War. The very day he was assassinated, he had sent a French journalist to Cuba with instructions of trying to open a dialogue with Fidel Castro to see if he could normalize relations between the United States and Cuba. And now we find out he was going to go into joint space exploration with Khrushchev.
Jim, okay. Let's go back a little bit. And I don't know if you, you know, have a lot of knowledge of Cuba and Castro. I was only I was only 9 years old at the time of that revolution. I had always been told that Castro and the United States they were working together.
They absolutely were. George, when I was in high school, you know, high school boys are, you know, they're gung-ho, the hormones are flowing. Me and my friends, we all talked about going down to Cuba and joining with Fidel Castro to overthrow the evil dictator Batista.
Right. Okay? Other than the mob.
Yeah.
The mob
and he was supplied by the CIA. We helped Castro take over in Cuba.
What happened then?
What happened very simply was is that they found out he was a nationalist, and he was trying to do what was in the best interest of the Cuban people. He threw the mafia off the island, and he began to nationalize some of the banking institutions down there, along with United Fruit. And all of a sudden, they're going, "Oh my God, this guy's bad for our business.
We backed the wrong guy, right?"
Yeah. So what did they do then? They said he's probably a communist. So they passed resolutions, blockaded the island, cut Castro off from the rest of the world, which left him only two choices: drive, blow away, or deal with the Soviets. Well, he began to deal with the Soviets, and this cry of communists became a self-fulfilling prophecy. See, we told you he was a communist. He's dealing with the Russians. Well, yeah, we forced him into it.
And Che Guevara was working with Castro at the time, wasn't he?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was another just, starry-eyed socialist idealist. You know, they were just, they had seen what our form of capitalism had done to their island.
See, I knew that at one time we were helping and supporting him, and then all of a sudden the whole thing flip-flopped.
Exactly. We more or less got him into office, and then when he started doing things that went contrary to the neo-colonial policy, foreign policy that we wanted, then he became anathema, and they turned on him, just like we did Saddam Hussein. You know, he fought that 8-year war with Iran on our behalf. And then the worst thing they've tagged him with was gassing the Kurdish people. But who sold him the gas? We did.
We did.
You know,
did.
Yeah, he was a 2-bit 10-horn dictator, but he was our 2-bit 10-horn dictator until he defaulted on his international bank loans, and that's when he became the new Hitler.
Oh, same thing with Manuel Noriega in Panama.
Exactly. And it's really funny because drugs fits in there, too. Manuel Noriega was simply charging too much corrupt money, and he was clogging up the drug routes. A year after our invasion of Panama, and it was ostensibly we went down there to grab Noriega, who we claimed all of a sudden, even though he was our guy, we put him into office, we armed him, we supplied him, and then all of a sudden we claimed he's a big drug dealer. Yep. And we ran down there and we invaded the country and we got him. And yet a year later, according to U.S. News and World Report, there was 3 times more drugs flowing through Panama than when he had been in power.
Oh, I tell you what, though, Jim, the greatest story never told is the fact that he is, I believe, in a federal prison in Marion, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And nobody, not you, not me, nobody can get to this guy to do an interview with him.
You can't get to him. And in fact, what I think is the greatest travesty of justice in the world was when he was brought up here and put on trial for these drug charges, the federal judge in charge said he could not bring up anything having to do with the U.S. government, which means he couldn't defend himself saying I was only doing what they told me to do.
Can you imagine the kind of interview he was involved in that bank scandal? What was the name of that?
BCCI?
Yeah, that's it. He was part of that, too.
That's right. And who was at the heart of the BCCI bank scandal? The Bush family. It's the same way with the savings and loan. I mean, you know, this is the same old gang. In fact, let me tell you, let's go back. Let me give you, your listeners a little bit of history. The one thing Richard Nixon did that everybody almost universally gave him good credit for was the fact that he opened diplomatic relations with China. Well, that was not lost on him. So the next thing you know, he makes a trip to Russia, and he comes back talking about, quote, detente.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He was going to reach an agreement with Russia. And he, too, saw his claim to fame in history if he could end the Cold War. But it didn't happen for 2 reasons. One, he got caught up in Watergate and was forced to resign or face impeachment. And And by the way, that would have brought out too many ugly details, such as in the Watergate tapes, if you'll recall, he was always talking about the whole Bay of Pigs thing. In fact,
he ended
up paying $2 million in hush money to E. Howard Hunt, one of the Watergate burglars, because he said, we don't want to break open the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Well,
strangely, Jim, had Watergate not occurred, he would have been perceived as one of the best presidents we ever had.
That is very possibly true. But I believe it was H.R. Haldeman wrote a book, and he said he finally came to understand, that was one of Nixon's top aides, and he finally came to understand, and when Nixon was talking about the whole Bay of Pigs thing, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yes. So Watergate drove Nixon out, and he appointed Gerald Ford to take his place,
and Ford, of course, replaced Agnew first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then he appointed him president, so he became our only unelected president. And so Gerald Ford named Dick Cheney as his chief of staff, and Donald Rumsfeld as his Secretary of Defense. And these two guys said, no, we can't end the Cold War because the Soviets have hidden weapons of mass destruction. And there was a little bit of a scandal at the time because the CIA said, well, how do you know that? We don't know that. And they said, well, we have, secret sources of information.
You think they made that up?
Well, in the light of history, of course they made it up. Yeah. There were, that wasn't true, but it kept the Cold War going and kept the war machine, cranking out those profits. So
these two
guys who then later told us they led the charge saying we had to invade Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction, and that turned out to be bogus. And now these are the same two guys that are telling us we're probably going to have to invade Iran. Why? Because they're working on weapons of mass destruction. I mean, how many times do these guys have to be proven wrong before people start going, wait a minute?
And one of them has stock in a company that's going to make zillions with this flu vaccine.
Exactly. And it was Rumsfeld, as head of Merck Pharmaceuticals, who pushed through aspartame through Congress, even over the objections of federal certification officers. And now there's a growing awareness and a growing scandal about how aspartame changes to formaldehyde in your system, and over a period of time, it'll just break down your immunization system and cause all kinds of problems.
Isn't formaldehyde used to embalm people?
Exactly.
And I don't know why I'm laughing.
Crying. It's a clincher. They say the pharmaceutical people, the aspartame is a sweetener that they put in diet soft drinks. Okay, if you're drinking Diet Coke or Diet Dr. Pepper, Diet 7-Up, you're probably drinking aspartame. And they say, well, it's okay, it's safe, unless it's in moderate consumption,
right?
Yeah, it's okay unless it reaches temperatures of about 97 degrees, in which case the molecular chain changes form and it turns into formaldehyde.
But Jim, the body's 98.6.
Oh, hey, that's right. So there you go. It's the whole thing's just really amazing, but that's what happens when people put their faith in what people tell them.
When are people going to say, we've had enough? We've had enough of deception.
Question. Apparently nobody's prepared to say I've had enough. It's like, do it to me some more.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Then you also understand, back to the UFO thing, that it was Nixon who, according to his first wife and a fellow named Larry Warren and two or three other people, confided to these close friends and people he met that it was Nixon who took Jackie Gleason to an air base and showed him aliens.
And Gleason, apparently, Jim, was never the same after that.
That's right. It shook him to the core.
Stay with us. Hold that thought. We'll be back with you in a moment. We'll take this quick break. We'll come right back with you, Jim Mars, and then we'll open up the phone lines next hour. We will have lots to talk about. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And with our guest Jim Mars tonight, and we'll be back with Jim. We're going to pick it up by talking about the Richard Nixon UFO case when he talked to Jackie Gleason. And the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Jim, pick up that story with Nixon and Gleason again, and then you can go on from there.
Right. Gleason told several acquaintances that he had been taken to a secret air base by his buddy, President Nixon, and shown aliens and spacecraft.
And I think it was out, Homestead,
he never
right?
never was quite the same. That really changed his world. What I was going to mention, though, was we had mentioned Gerald R. Ford, our only unelected president, and you correctly pointed out that he had been appointed by Nixon to take Spiro Agnew's place as vice president. And then, of course, when Nixon resigned, then Gerald Ford became president. Gerald Ford, of course, had already earned his stripes in government cover-up by being on the Warren Commission. He was the commissioner who heard more testimony than any other, and it's also now been established that he was a snitch on the Warren Commission to the J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. So he already had pretty well proven himself in cover-up, and therefore it was really interesting. In 1966 at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, the college dean and the local civil defense director and 87 co-eds had a UFO experience, and they watched this thing cavort around for almost 4 hours. And Project Blue Book sent an investigator up there, and he held a press conference and said, well, what they saw was swamp gas.
Oh, that was Hynek, wasn't it?
That was Hynek before he shifted, before he
became
came
a believer.
Out of the closet and said, now, listen, they've been telling me to say all this stuff, but there's really something going on.
Yep.
So that so incensed the good citizens of Michigan that they prevailed on their representative, Gerald R. Ford, who wrote a letter to the Armed Services Committee stating, quote, in the firm belief that the American public deserves a better explanation than has thus far been given by the Air Force, I strongly recommend that there is a committee to investigate the UFO phenomena. And so it did, in fact, result in a hearing by something called the Rivers Committee in April of 1966. And although literally hundreds, if not thousands, of UFO witnesses, along with scientists, pilots, officers of the various UFO organizations, conversant with some of the best cases, could have been called to this testimony, the committee restricted testimony to only three representatives of the Air Force, none of whom had ever claimed to have seen a UFO. And Ford never said anything about that, and, of course, he went on to be selected vice president and then became our only unelected president. Was it because he had covered up the UFO question so well?
And then defeated by Carter, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. But now, I've got to share with you and your audience probably the weirdest case that I've ever come across, and this is going to be so cool.
All right.
I am co-producing a documentary for the Discovery Channel called X-Ops.
X-Ops, okay.
X-Ops. And what we do is we have an incredible team of balance between scientific types and psychics and even an Indian shaman. And we go out, and instead of just reporting on UFO stories or ghost stories or Bigfoot stories or whatever, we go out with this team and we try to penetrate to the truth. Okay? And the first one, I just got back from New Mexico, and the first investigation that this group has undertaken was due to a story I stumbled across some time back there in Roswell, when I was actually doing a documentary on something entirely different. But I needed a old-looking medical facility, and I found it at the New Mexico Rehabilitation Center. And while I was there arranging to see if we could shoot some tape there, the assistant to the director said, well, yes, certainly. And she was just delightful. She was so cooperative.
Yeah.
She said, go up on the second floor down that long hallway and said, just do what you want to up there. Said, we mostly use that area for storage. And then she had to add, the staff doesn't like to go up there.
So they send you, right?
Yeah, they got me going. You know, my journalistic hackles went up, and I said, well, why not? And I began to hear this story, and George, I couldn't believe my ears. And over the days that we were shooting there, I went and talked to switchboard operator and the nurses and the computer systems and that analyst and even maintenance people. And the story was that that hallway was haunted, okay? But then I finally met one of the nurses who had actually seen this apparition. I mean, George, you probably realize that, and I certainly do as an old police reporter, that you can go to almost any hospital and you can probably find a ghost story there. Okay?
Absolutely. There's something somewhere in that facility that somebody will tell you something.
That's right. So I thought this was really interesting, but what I found out blew my mind. When I finally talked to one of the nurses who had seen this thing, she said, well, it's not human. It's only about 4 foot tall and with a great big head and big dark eyes and kind of this silvery suit type thing. I'm going, holy cow, it sounds like an alien.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a ghost.
It sounds like an alien. So then it gets better. I got to checking, and I found out that up until the time the base was closed, that this medical facility, now run by the state of New Mexico, had been the base hospital for Walker Air Force Base there at Roswell.
And no.
And it was built about 1950, so I went back and got the original plans, and what did I find out? This wing of the hospital was built over the exact spot of the old wooden base hospital of Roswell Army Airfield.
Where they may have taken those alien bodies.
Where they claim that the alien bodies were taken. So there's an alien ghost in Roswell.
That's
now,
a great
story.
Now,
we went with the team, and we took plasma detectors and heat sensors and infrared, and we took everything, and we took some well-credentialed psychics, this Indian shaman who comes from that very area and knows that the Native Americans there have stories about encounters with these space visitors that go back hundreds of years, if not thousands. And we were determined to find out the truth, what was really going on there. And I'm going to titillate you with this, and I'm not going to tell you what we found, but I want to tell you, we found stuff, and it was not nothing there. It was absolutely incredible. So just keep your eyes open for the first report from the ex-ops.
I love that. I'm very interested in the shaman, in the fact that they have talked about alien visitations hundreds of years ago in that general region. So when they probably heard about the Roswell story, Jim, they weren't surprised, were they?
No, not really. In fact, it's interesting if you go and really start talking to those people and you're not making any judgments and you're just being open and honest with them, you have to pry some of this stuff out of them, but yes. They've known about this for a long, long time.
I think beyond just these kinds of stories and cases, one of the biggest boosts to the very strong possibility of alien visitations, I think, and you just touched on it, was when Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who head up Project Blue Book, switched his allegiances from whatever the Air Force wanted him to say to the fact that he believed that we were being visited. And I think that's a tremendous story that most major media never picked up on. I mean, no. Here's a guy who was employed by the government to investigate UFOs, who was the biggest debunker and he changed him, and he became probably the biggest supporter of visitation.
Absolutely. And you know what? I met Dr. Heilig and I interviewed him years ago, and that was after he had made his flip over. And
swamp gas.
Yeah. The thing is, he was hired to debunk UFOs, and it finally just got to him because he would go out and investigate, and he would find out there was really something there and something going on. And it finally, he just said, you know, I'm sure he said to himself, I can't do this. I've got to tell the truth. And you're right. When he was the government's foremost debunker, he got all the press in the world. But when he changed and said, wait a minute, folks, you know, there really is something there, all of a sudden, you know, they dropped him like a hot potato. Nobody wanted to quote him. I happened to interview him for the newspaper I was working for in West Texas, and he was very outspoken.
He wrote the book, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that Steven Spielberg turned into the movie and even gave him a little part of it.
You know, That's right. He actually shows up in that movie, doesn't he?
Holds on, you know, he's got his pipe in his hand and puts it in his mouth, and that was his scene. But he wrote that book.
Exactly. Now, of course, you know, we've talked about on Coast to Coast before the story I investigated in Montana, The Secret of Red Gate. And that's available. That documentary is that won an award is still available both on my website, jimmars.com, and on The Secrets of Red Gate.
Tell us about that again, Jim.
Well, that was simply the fact that we went up to Montana to a little bitty town of 3,000 people, and we managed to get more than two dozen signed releases and interviewed people who had all had encounters or some kind of stories with UFOs. And what we did there was kind of a forerunner to what we're doing with the X-Ops, which is we not only got their conscious memories of their encounters, but then we had several of them undergo hypnosis, and we drew more information out under hypnosis, and then we subjected them to lie detectors. And that was interesting because not one of the people that we had take a lie detector test showed any signs of deception. Whatever it was, they truly believed it. And then we had eight tested remote viewers take a look at what had happened up there, and the results were quite astounding. In fact, I'm still just blown away when, for example, one woman and her brother told about when they were children there outside of the little town of Deer Lodge that they had gone into the nearby woods and played with their little gray friends, okay? And so... And so the brother still consciously remembers that, and he was kind of upset that the sister didn't remember it because he said, well, you were there. In fact, you hogged the conversation. You know?
That's great.
But it all came out, the sister's memory came out under hypnosis. But then we turned to the remote viewers, and grab this. This is the way it went. One person knew that we wanted to find out what happened to the two children in 1950. And so that was basically the question that we wanted the remote viewers to answer. But as you well know, you don't ask that question because then you're kind of leading them. They know mm-hmm. what you want. They might just conjure up anything. So he changed it into a coordinate number. He sent that number to another person who had no idea of what we were doing, what the question was or anything. All he had was the number. He passed it on to a third person who did not know what was involved or what the question was. He only had this coordinate number, which represented the question. Then he parceled out this number, the target number, to eight separate remote viewers who lived in different cities and different states. They're scattered all around the country. And they all did a remote viewing session based on this number. And they came back, and as you would expect from eight separate witnesses, there were varying degrees of detail, but all eight said these were two children who went in the woods near their home and met with aliens.
I love
it. Just blew me away. How could they have known that if there was nothing to it?
You kind of remind me of the modern-day Frank Edwards. Remember him?
Yes,
one of the great old, great old journalists of his time investigating UFOs. He was one of the best.
That's right. And just think how far we've come, George. Back in the 50s, you know, the burning question among the researchers into UFOs was, do they come from Mars or do they come from Venus? And then by the 60s and 70s and 80s, we'd gotten a little more sophisticated, and the question became, do they come from Alpha Centauri or Zeta Reticula 4, you know? And today, we've even gotten more sophisticated, and now the question has become, do they come from another galaxy? Do they come from another time? Do they come from another dimension? And so, as we've progressed along, we've also learn more and more about how they operate, and we're talking about electromagnetic fields of energy. And here's one for you, George. You've always heard the UFO stories that the UFO comes over and people's cars stop, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And then they go away and they start up again, right?
Yep.
Okay, but have you ever heard anybody say that when the UFO went away, the starter came on and went run, and it starts up again? No. The starter doesn't start.
No, that's true. The car just goes on again.
Now, how can it do that?
I don't know.
It does that because when it enters the electromagnetic field of the UFO, gravity stops, time stops, and those pistons, you know, and the valves, they just stop. And then when the field goes away, it fires and it goes. And
pick up again.
The engine continues running.
Suspended in time.
Exactly. And that also accounts for the missing time. Because to the people in the field, things are still going on, or they're still sleeping, or whatever they're doing. But outside the field, time is moving right on along, and that's why I heard on one of your promos, you said you've had the experience of going from point A to point B and not really understanding how you got there because the time was all off.
Exactly. A couple miles. Of course, that truck driver in that promo, 150 miles and didn't know where he went.
With a load of dynamite? Oh, my God. I hope he didn't come by my place.
of everything you've investigated, everything, I'm talking about rule by secrecy, crossfire, the Kennedy assassination, UFOs, what's the one thing that keeps coming up as a common denominator there, Jim?
Oh, excuse me. There I go again. I think the common denominator actually can be found detailed in my book, Rule by Secrecy. And the common denominator is a handful of people who are attempting to control and rule this world. And as a result, they have got to keep certain things under wraps. For example, I don't think they care if we know that there are space aliens out there. What they care about is that if we know that there is space aliens out there, then we know that there is alternative technologies out there, and that would undermine their monopolies over petrochemicals and energy and transportation and pharmaceuticals and communications and all like that. And this, to me, George, is the biggest conspiracy going on in the world today. I just read the number yesterday. Every day, 6 million children die of hunger around the world.
Oh,
now that's unconscionable.
That's
unconscionable.
Jim,
how could that be? You don't want that. I don't want that. So, and you know also, George, that we have the technology available to us today. That doesn't have to be that way.
That's true. Stay with us, Jim. Back in a moment. Phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.